Previously on How I Got Into College.
I was going to Tufts, and my parents, I mean, they started paying. I got a roommate who was a local guy that I actually met in middle school, which was pretty cool that I was going to know my roommate. My parents bought all my round-trip plane tickets to Boston for every holiday. They started receiving the invitations from the vice president and provost and vice provost cocktail party in our region. And I was going to Tufts, man. That's how it was. I graduated high school and was going to Medford, Massachusetts come August. I called the University of Miami, thanking them and politely declining because I wanted to free up the money for any student that might be in line. Over the course of the summer, Alfred Spellman, my producing partner, and I got to talking. Alfred was going to go in August to Gainesville, and I was going to go to Tufts. I don't remember the exact kind of length or development of the conversation, but Alfred and I decided that we wanted to stay in Miami and continue to build our production company together. And I said, well, maybe I could go to the University of Miami. And Alfred hadn't applied at the University of Miami. So he said, well, let me see if I can't apply to UM. This is almost August, dude.
Yeah.
Right? I swear to God, he calls up the School of Communication, and he got accepted to the School of Communication through the film program at the University of Miami. And so I went to my mom and my dad, but more my mom.
Welcome to How I Got Into College. It's a show about the biggest decision of your life, or so you're told. But really, it's about acceptance, rejection, big moments and the little bits of luck that shape the people you know and the journeys you don't. In other words, every hero has an origin story, and this is one of them. I'm David Whalen, and today we're picking up where we left off last week with Billy Corbin and the University of Miami.
I'm Billy Corbin. I went to the University of Miami, and this is how I got into college.
When we left off, award-winning filmmaker Billy Corbin had started speaking truth to power in middle school, started a film production company in high school, and was headed to Tufts for college. But all of that was about to change.
And so I went to my mom and my dad, but more my mom. And I said, Mom, Alfred has applied and been accepted to UM. And we would like to stay in Miami and continue to work, you know, and build our company. And my mother was not happy at all. And I think, Miami, to be fair, university had a reputation at the time as Suntan U.
Yeah.
Let's be real. And so my mother was very enthusiastic, very bullish on Tufts. Not to mention, as I told you, they were already pretty well invested into it at that point, and financially and otherwise, and emotionally and otherwise. And so my mother said, my parents are just, God, they're just the best. They just have done everything for my brother and I our whole lives. And we've heard our fair share of no's, but not on the big stuff, man.
Yeah.
Not on the big stuff. And she could not have been, even though this was heartbreaking for her, I think. I'm putting that, she never described it to me as such. That's how I perceived it at the time. And it gave me no joy to break her heart.
No.
But my parents were always firmly rooted in the ideal of the American dream, of that you create a better life for your children, you put your kids, you put your kids through school, and you help them pursue their dreams. And oh God, they're insanely wonderful people. And my mother said, yes, but she said, first of all, you have to call the University of Miami and see if you still have a slot, number one, because I turned them down at that point weeks, if not months earlier. And second, you have to have all the scholarship money available to you, because I had accumulated some money in my acting career that was to go to college, but mom was willing to pay full freight on Tufts, Where I got zero scholarships, by the way. Okay, and I was out of town. I was out of state. I was paying. I was gonna do my acting dough, my parents' money, and loans. There's no doubt about that. And at Tufts, but at UM, she's like, you need to get all of that money back. And third, I needed to get straight A's. And I'm sorry, there was a fourth thing. I needed to live on campus at least for the first year. Okay. Because she really wanted me to have that dorm life experience and not be a commuter student. She really, really wanted me to have that independence and experience that independence. And so I said, okay. And I got on the phone. And I don't know if this speaks to the incompetence or disorganization at UM or the hand of fate, but they had all my money. None of them had received my messages or my letters declining the money. All the money was still available, and I had my slot still available, and we showed up on campus at move-in day. I did not have, like, I had a Tufts, like, my roommate in advance and everything, so I showed up at move-in day, at check-in, basically, and was like, I need a roommate, and they're like, well, we got this dude from New York, who's also in the School of Communication, you know, has a similar same major as you. So you'll have some classes together and everything. And here he is, Lee. He and I are friends today. He is now a documentary producer himself. That was it. I went to University of Miami. I lived in the dorms my freshman year. And I didn't start drinking until I was 21. But I think all of the guys on my floor more than made up for my not drinking. Right. But there were some crazy fun times nonetheless that I had sober, but I was very studious.
Remember that deal that Billy had with his mom about getting straight A's? Well, that was about to hit a bump.
And I was very interested in my academics, particularly because of my deal with my mother to get straight A's, which I did not get. I got, an A minus and a B. Over the course of my years at one A minus and one B. And that A minus I actually had to fight for with my professor, who had given me a B plus. And I had to go and negotiate with him, a very prominent, Benton Becker, may he rest in peace, a very prominent lawyer. He was private counsel to Gerald Ford during the Watergate scandal.
Wow.
And Benton Becker actually hand-delivered, I believe by helicopter, if I'm not mistaken, the pardon from President Ford to Richard Nixon. And it was a Supreme Court decision that Benton Becker gave to Gerald Ford. It's the Burdick decision from 1915, okay? And this is important because I read Bob Woodward's book, I think it was called Shadow, about the presidencies that followed Watergate being in the shadow of the Watergate scandal. And Benton Becker was interviewed for the book. And so I went and got the book, or at least snuck into Borders and read the index and found all of Benton Becker's references and quotes in the book. And he had given a photocopy or a ditto copy or whatever the technology was at the time. He had handed the Burdick decision, or a summary of the Burdick decision, in 1974, to his client, President Ford. And the Burdick decision essentially says that acceptance of a presidential pardon or a federal pardon is tantamount to an admission of guilt or a confession that you are guilty of the crimes you are being pardoned for. And when if I remember correctly, when Bob Woodward interviewed President Ford for the book, when he asked him about the very touchy and really career-ending issue of the pardon of Richard Nixon, I remember Gerald Ford took his wallet out of his pocket, and out of his wallet took a small piece of folded up paper with the Burdick decision on it that Benton Becker had given him.
Wow.
And literally carried that with him.
Yeah.
As essentially not the justification, but the peace that he had in his heart.
Yeah.
With the decision to pardon or so Benton Becker, who I adored, and I took college is like a game. You know, you have to get the points to win, right? And the points are the credits. The points are the GPA points, you know, that you need. You know, like, it's just a game. And you go to your academic advisor, and they tend to give you not very good advice. And they don't really tell you that it's a game and how best to play it. They go, oh, well, some kids like this teacher and some students like that teacher. But, you know, it's – and you have a very finite number of courses and teachers, especially at a private school like UM. And you're – you know, and you try to navigate your way. And unfortunately, it's really not until the end of your college career do you realize that, oh, shit, where all the mistakes you made, you know, and how you misplayed. Yeah. Your hand. I mean, it's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking, but fortunately I took two leaves of absence to make our documentaries over the course of my college career. So I got to go back as like a wiser adult, you know, and the stakes felt lower for me. And I had a lot more fun, in college as it progressed. So I took Bettendecker for every class I could. I fell in love with him, and I'm like, this is a guy. I need to learn everything I can. I took multiple Supreme Court issues classes, or constitutional law classes with him. I took a Supreme Court class with him. Everything I could take with him, I took with him. And he was a wonderful guy, and his wife was a wonderful woman. And I think I met his children, too, who were adults at that time. But Becker gave me a B+ in a class. And the following semester, I went to him, and I said, what are you doing to me? What are you doing? And I'm like, my mother, you know, gets these report cards. They get sent to my parents' house, you know? I'm like, you're going to kill her. You're going to kill my mother, you know? And he's like, well, Billy, he had this great voice. Well, a little slightly nasally. Well, Bill, they're very authoritative nonetheless. And well, Billy... you know, I thought, and basically what he said to me was what teachers had been telling me at least since middle school, definitely since high school, and that I was an A student, but I wasn't trying hard enough. Like, I wasn't putting forth the effort because I was distracted with my work and just, you know, and I think his word was, you did the bare minimum. And I was like, yeah, but I mean... But it was good enough to get it. And a lot of his class also was subjective. You know, it wasn't all these objective kind of, you know, Scantron multiple choice tests. It was very, you know, short answer essay driven. So he got to pick and choose his. And I was definitely a favorite of his. Make no mistake. But he was making a point, is what he was doing. And I said to him, I said, Benton, I said, you've made your point. The report card went home to my mother. So that point was made loud and clear. The A- means more to me now than the B+ means to you. And he says, you're right. I don't know how long I sat in his office trying to persuade him, but that was ultimately the simplest argument was the argument that ultimately persuaded this very esteemed attorney.
I
that was the line. I said, the A- means more to me now than the B+ means to you, because he had already made his point with the B+, like whatever he wanted to accomplish, he had already accomplished. And he said, you're right. And I literally pulled out of my briefcase a change of grade form a blank change of grade form that I had obtained and brought to him, because he was an adjunct professor. And, you know, these adjuncts kind of like are, you know, they're not very steeped in all of the logistics, you know, of a school. I later was an adjunct professor briefly at a private arts college. And so I know, like, well, I didn't even keep office hours. Like, I didn't have to that way at that school, but like, it, like, I was just lucky this guy was in the office, you know, during office hours, so he would not have known how to change a grade if he wanted to do it. So I knew that going in, and I brought the form, and he signed the form right then and there. So now I got that, like I said, I brought me to an A-, and then I got a B in this science class.
And about that science class.
So it wasn't even one of my majors. It was a science class. I'll call it an unelective. How about that? I unelected to take, you know, to take this class. I totally not consensually, forced to take this class. And here's the funny thing. So I needed 6 science credits, right? Which meant every class at that point was roughly 3 credits. So I needed 2 science classes. So I took this science class my freshman year. It was a seminar class, so there was like 8,000 kids. They might as well have had the class at the Orange Bowl. Like, there was so many kids. None of us were human beings. We were all, so, you know, the last 4 digits of our social security numbers, you know, or our student ID numbers. And then my buddy, my roommate Lee, had the same class, and he was a New Yorker. So we would set the clock alarm to Howard Stern every morning. So Howard Stern would come on at 7 a.m. or 6:30 or whatever. It was not incentive to get out of bed. We would just lay there listening to Howard Stern, for crying out. And he would be like, are you going to class? I'd be like, no. Are you going to? No. And then if he wouldn't go, I would have to go. Like, I would feel, very rarely did neither of us go. I'd feel obliged to go and take notes and whatever. So I would go. And it was Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, dude, for like, at like 7 a.m. It was a nightmare. And, you know, you'd be walking across campus. Like, nobody else would be out there. Everybody out there was like a zombie. You know, invariably at the fountain I passed, someone had dumped detergent into it. So it was all bubbling over, you know, a bunch of drunk frat dudes or whatever overnight. So it was just like the classic, like, there might as well have been like underwear or a bra on the flagpole. It was just the worst, worst hour of like college. And so you'd go in, and our professor, he was this eccentric, brilliant guy. But like, I don't know how I figured this out, but I thought, you know what? I'm a nameless, faceless yutz to this guy. I'm going to go during office hours, which turned out were extremely lonely for this guy. And I'm just going to hang out with him and talk to him and ask him questions. And just so in the event I get in trouble or whatever, like, this guy will know who I am, you know? So like, and I just figured that out on my own, just diplomacy. I was a poli sci major. So I was trying to, you know, politic my way through, you know, through everything that I could. And so I, this is the class I got my be in. And I was so pissed. I was so pissed that I did not take my the other required science class until like way at the end of my college career. Because my academic advisor every year would be like, oh, you still need this credit. That's really all your academic advisor was good for in those. Like, oh, you still need these credits. You still need those credits. But never a good recommendation on how to get those credits.
Right.
You know? So they said, I don't know how I happened upon this, but because I had taken 2 leaves of absence to make our first documentary, I found myself wanting to go in a summer session. The first thing my academic advisor said was that the scholarship does not apply to the summer. So I would be out of pocket on that. And I had some loans, which were great. I mean, that was practically free money. I mean, the interest on that was like nothing, you know?
Right.
So I was like, whatever, I'll take. And there was some reason, I think I wanted to focus on my bullshit classes, which to me were like the science class that I, you know, that weren't my major, you know, that I was required to take. I wanted to just be able to, I'm like, if I did those over the summer, I thought that maybe that would be better, right? I was a total shot in the dark. It was just a roll of the dice I was taking. So I'll never forget. Dr. DiResta was his name. Another one of these seminar-sized class, not quite as big as my first one, but like years later, we're in this. It was a marine biology course. Also, Miami has is the number 1 marine biology school in like the country. So I thought that would be cool to take an oceanography class, you know. Yeah. So with the Dr. DiResta, I'll never forget this. And maybe this is just an affect of a marine biologist, but walk into the class, and I think we had to go like every day. I had to schlep to Coral Gables down near South Miami every single day for like an hour or whatever it was, because, you know, you need the same number of course hours, you know, but you need to get it in the summer session, so whatever it was. And I swear to God, the guy walks in khaki cargo shorts and like a Hawaiian button-down shirt, like a Tommy Bahama shirt, and he was fun and funny and jovial and brilliant. And he said, here's the syllabus. There will be 2, of course, you'll be graded on, or I'll be taking the roll. So attendance will factor in, you know, whatever it was, 20 or 25%. And the rest of your grade is half your take-home midterm and half your take-home final. And I was like, get out of here. because I was a very good note taker. I was very like studious in class. And he's like, and yep. all the final, the midterm exam and the final exam are all from your notes. So if you're here and you take good note, and I don't do a review for yep. it, I just, you take good notes, everything will be there. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. And I realized, wait, we're not just on summer break. The professors are on summer
right.
break.
Yes.
They don't want to make this job any more difficult than it has to be. This guy wants to grade. He wants to take roll and grade two papers is what he is. What he wants
this is
to
back
do.
To middle school.
Yeah. And not even papers. They were multiple choice. I think some short answers, too. So he made his job a little bit tougher with the short answers. But like, I was like, I was so pissed, David. I was like, why didn't my academic advisor? Here you yeah. are, like a young, wet behind the ears, frightened freshman, you know, and like, why don't they say, listen, you are an artist, okay? You know, you're here for film. You're yeah, I mean, he was there for poli sci, but you're here for film. You know, like you are a right-brained person. You know, you're a language arts and history. You're good at civic and that kind of shit. But when it comes to the math and sciences, you need every advantage you can get. So why don't you take Dr. Duresta's oceanography class in the summer? Nobody told me to do that. And so I was so pissed that, like, no one tells you how to play this game. No one tells you how to get the points. Listen, everything is what you make of it. And I found professors I wasn't just looking, to be clear, for the easiest classes. I found Benton Becker. I found the preeminent expert yeah. on China who literally was one of the few professors who wrote the textbook at Miami. That's not a thing. She was a Harvard professor. She was the advisor to, I think, the House Committee on Chinese Relations. I sought her out because I wanted to be challenged in film and poli-sci. But when it came to film and poli-sci, I wanted to be challenged. When it came yep. to math and science, fortunately, I was able to test out of a bunch of things thanks to my standardized test scores, but I was scared. I was scared that I was going to blow my deal with my mom to get straight A's because of some math and science classes. And I needed the help and I needed the advice. And my academic advisor did not properly advise me. So I needed to go out and seek A, the best professors that would challenge me in the courses that I wanted, you know, that I wanted to be challenged in and that I wanted to be educated in. And it's not that I didn't want to be educated in math and science. It's just that those were not my strengths. They were not my majors. Yeah. And I needed to not kill my mother by seeing right. anything less than A's on my report card, which at that point I had now done twice. So I did. Although she, as I took the leaves of absence and pushed off graduation till 03, she started to care a little bit less. And I did too, which is also, once you have those low stakes and you go back to college as an adult, oh man, was it fun? Was it so yeah. much fun? And my mom did that too. My mom, you know, went to University of Tampa and then transferred to American University, where my dad was at, not for that reason, but her friend was there. I mean, that, and she, her friend Larry, who later became her husband, was there. She knew him from like since elementary school. But she, I think basically right after her senior year, became pregnant with me. And so any plans that she had had for her further education basically got derailed for, as it turned out, 20 and a half years, because it wasn't until my brother left home that she went back to school and got her master's, which is pretty extraordinary to do.
It really is.
Over 20 years later. But she had a great time getting her master's 20 years later because, again, the stakes are lower. You know, you've been out in the world. She's raised two children. She bought a house, sold a house. She, you know, like she's lived some life. She had a divorce. You know, she lived some life, you know. And so you go back and you're like, okay, well, when you're young and you go to school, I mean, this is your life. You know, your yeah. life is the – and you're just like – you think everything matters. You think this is the most important thing, and my grades are the most important. My grades were important to me, but they were more important because in college, because I didn't want to disappoint my mom, you know, and my dad. But by then, by the time you go out in the world, you realize there's more to life than college and school in general. Then you come back and you're like happy-go-lucky. I had the best time when I had like 6 credits left or 9 credits left. After my second leave of absence, I needed to go back to take 2 or 3 courses to finish up. And I had the time of my life in those classes. Not because I was partying, you know, but because right. I was like, I enjoyed the classes so much. I got yeah. so much out of them. And the stakes were so much lower that I just was able to excel in them much easier because I didn't take it as seriously. And I got straight A's. That was, you know, when I wasn't worrying about it, was when I was able to excel even more so, at it. And I, there's times I miss school. I really do. I think it was just, it was a lot of fun, and it was something that I was good at. I think if you're not good at it, then you don't miss it.
When we come back, Billy takes time off from school for a very good reason. Welcome back to How I Got Into College. I'm David Whalen. Billy Corbin had turned down Tufts to go to the University of Miami and continue his film production company. And now that company is about to start a major project.
One of the things that you were working on was Raw Deal. How did you first become sort of aware of that story? And what was that process like for you of saying, okay, I got to take time away from school to go do this?
It was all college. It was a college story. I knew about it through college. It was all about college. And it's what really, it was our first documentary. It was actually when we chose to become documentarians to make that movie. We were studying screenwriting, and we had already done, you know, as I said, some scripted educational videos and stuff like that. But this was our pivot into nonfiction filmmaking, where we have been ever since now for over 20 years. And so it was a college story. It was, we started to hear news of the alleged sexual assault of an exotic dancer at a fraternity house at the University of Florida in Gainesville. And, you know, news travels fast like that. This was the dawn of internet news as well. You know, we could get the Independent Florida Alligator, which was the student-run newspaper in Gainesville. We could get, you know, I think the Gainesville Sun was online. So we were getting news, and we were hearing about it from our friends who, you know, you grew up in Miami. Invariably, you have friends who go on to the major state schools, to University of Florida in Gainesville, to FSU and Florida State University in Tallahassee. And so I had friends everywhere in those schools, huge state schools. And so 50,000 plus students at that time. And so, and that was undergrad alone. And I was going to University of Miami, I think it was like 8,000 or something, undergraduate. And so I'll never forget. I heard from two friends. The thing that was so extraordinary about the case was that the entire evening's events at and around the fraternity house at this Big Brother, Little Brother pledge event had been videotaped by one of the fraternity brothers, including a private party that continued in a private room of the fraternity house outside of the common area with one of the two exotic dancers that led to the accusations of rape. And so it was all caught on videotape. Even though Florida has always been a sunny place for shady people, we have these sunshine laws. And so the media started requesting it, and the public started requesting it, and from the clerk of courts and the state attorney's office. And so the exotic dancer's attorney went to court to argue that she should be protected under rape shield laws, having been the victim of a sexual assault, that her identity and certainly the evidence or the videotape evidence of her assault should be confidential, is an exemption under the public records laws. And a judge disagreed and found them to be evidence of the misdemeanor filing a false police report case that she had been arrested for. So they released this videotape footage, and there was a backlog of public records requests, and people were waiting weeks at a time to get their copy of what became quite repulsively known as the, quote, rape tape, end quote. And so we had heard about this, and I remember talking within days of each other to two of my friends who I grew up with in the old neighborhood, all, again, you know, middle class or working class kind of Jewish American neighborhood in the North Miami Beach area. And the reason why I bring that up is to say that our life experience as young men was very similar. You know, we grew up in similar, you know, genders, socioeconomic status, geography, you know, in the neighborhood. And so our life experience going into college was was common amongst us. So yep. I spoke to one of the friends who said, have you heard about the rape tape? Have you heard about the Delta Chi incident involved with the stripper? I said, yes, I have heard about it. He said, I just went to a keg party where they were showing the videotape, because that's what would happen if you were the first people on your block or whatever to get the tape. people would have a kegger, and so people could watch the tape like it was Rocky Horror or something. And the kid said to me, my friend said to me, I said, well, what did you think? Like, what happened? He said it was repulsive. It was disgusting. Not only that all these people were gathered to watch this woman be victimized, but what these men did to her on the tape, how they belittled her, how they treated her, what they did to her. He goes, I barely slept or eaten or drank like since I saw it. I've just been like in a constant state of just disgust with like humanity and my college community. And within days of that, I spoke to another friend. Again, we all know each other, all from the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, did you see, we started talking about the case. And he said, oh yeah, I just saw the videotape. And he said, that lying, and imagine just various repulsive negative things to say about this woman. And she lied, and she cried rape, and she falsely accused these poor guys. I'm glad they arrested her. She's nothing but a liar, and she should be in jail, and these poor boys. And I was like, holy shit. I was like, how is it that two people, reasonable, educated, almost adults, but again, with very similar life experiences and backgrounds, could watch the same objective video footage and totally disagree about whether or not they witnessed a consensual act or not. And I was like, well, that is, I mean, I had already, you know, learned that the essential ingredient in drama is conflict. And that conflict was about as powerful as any I had ever heard before. And interestingly, in high school, our senior play was the play Rashomon. Based on the Akira Kurosawa play. And I had a role in that show, and of course had to read and study that play with Dr. Gennaro, who directed it. And so I was like, oh, this is a really, I said, I would frame the story that way with a he said, she said, and then what the videotape shows.
Yep.
We got access to the footage. We created a Bible, as we still do to this day. Now it's digital. Back then, we literally printed out every article we could get on the internet in 2000, and put it, or 99, and put it into a 3-ring binder. We punched the holes, and probably at Kinko's, and in a 3-ring binder, and created the Bible for the project in chronological order, and decided to take a leave of absence and to hit the literally put a few, you know, few grand together from friends and family and hit the road to Gainesville and start pounding the pavement and seeing what we couldn't get done there. And it was a really interesting, I never spent that much time in a college town before. You know, Miami is not a college town. Miami has a college campus in the middle of a big city. Gainesville or University of Florida is a very insulated, it's almost a town around a college campus, you know, not a college campus in a town or in a city. So it was very interesting. Very insulated, very surreal, and how, like in Miami, for example, there wasn't a very active Greek life. There were fraternities, but like you didn't go to Miami and feel compelled to join a social group, you know, you because you didn't have to, because, well, first I was local and I had friends, and but you knew where to go. It was a big city. You could find, you know, you could fit in and find friends and find groups and go to places without having to do that. In a small town like Gainesville, like, there's not that many places to go. There's not that many, you know, it's a big campus. So you want to find people that you can get along with. And I guess the Greek system has I never understood it, but I guess it had a place there that I just didn't understand because of having gone to the University of Miami, where it was not that big a deal, comparatively speaking, to a big insulated state school and campus environment. And so I got a real sense of that. I got a real sense of the dangers of the upsides of that life, but also the dangers of that life, of that lifestyle and that environment, particularly when it came to binge drinking and fraternity culture and mm-hmm. and culture of acquaintance and date rape. I thought it was a really, it was the best education I could have gotten in the sociology of and psychology of sexual politics and power and control on campus. Years later, I met a guy who was running a film department at a private art institute here in Miami. And he asked me to come in and do like a PowerPoint presentation or do a screening, a Q&A, something. It might have been Raw Deal, to tell you the truth. He had seen Raw Deal, I think, at a film festival years earlier and wanted me to bring it in. I think that's what it was, and screen it. And so, or it might have been Cocaine Cowboys, too. I don't remember. The point of the story is he said we went out for a drink afterwards, and he said, I would love for you to come and teach here. And I said, I don't have the time to do that. And he said, well, you know, what would the parameters have to be? And I threw out some very unreasonable criteria, and he said, done. So I started teaching a class there once a week, every Monday night for a couple years. And I go in, and I have to fill out some – he goes, listen, you have to do this HR stuff. It's just a formality. You've already got the job, but fill out the application. You'll have to go to some classes and some training. I said, that's fine. He said, and don't worry about where it says a college degree. You have an expert exemption because you're an established filmmaker, and your expertise, you know, allows you to come in without a college degree and be a professor. And I said, what are you talking about? He's like, oh, he goes, well, I read in an article years ago that you had taken a leave of absence to do Raw Deal, to do your first documentary. And I said, I did, but I promised my mother that I would go back and finish my degree. And I did. I went back and finished my degree. And he goes, oh, well, that's great. Then just write that you have your BS or whatever. And I was like, dude, you were going to hire me to be a college professor without having a college degree, even an undergraduate, let alone a master's.
Right.
And by the way, I thought that was cool, because I thought that, like, obviously you want your students to learn from people who have done it, you know, who've not just, you know, studied it or done it in theory. So I thought that was badass. Believe me, I love that he was, you know, that he was opening the doors to that way. But what it made me realize is how insignificant my college degree was. Because I realized nobody has ever asked me for my college degree, my diploma. Nobody has ever asked me my GPA. No one knows I graduated like Dean's List and I think summa cum laude. I don't even remember, like, you know, from University of Miami. Like, I don't even remember, because as important and influential as it has been in my life and my career, the journey was much more important than the destination. And I mean that on the micro and the macro level, meaning the journey of going to classes and socializing and interacting with professors and learning the system and the tricks of the trade and meeting the people that I met, both students and professors and faculty and administration, was far more important than what grade I got, you know, at the end of a semester, or what diplomas or degrees I wound up with, or what GPA I wound up with when all was said and done. To me in my life, obviously it's indispensable, because who I am today is informed by every experience, positive or negative, that I've ever had. But it made me realize that, okay, it didn't matter. The outcome or the result didn't matter as much as the experience and the process and the journey. And that was an education, you know, that was a life lesson, in and of itself.
Looking back now and knowing what you know, what would you tell the 17-year-old version of yourself about college before he went to college?
Keep it up. I'd say keep it up. The B+ I got in Benton Becker's class was important. The B that I got in the science class was important. I mean, certainly my 17-year-old me would have been pissed at the 40-year-old me that I didn't warn him about that,
right.
warn him
right.
to take Dr. or advise him to take Dr. Duresta's summer class in oceanography. So
yes.
Much of those mistakes, which were not major life tragedies, make no mistake of it, were so important, such important lessons, that such that I remember them now and are talking and are pretty excited to talk to you about them, because when the f*** else would anybody ever ask me about this?
Right.
and the college, you know, admissions and experience is so important to so many people. So to hear these stories, I think is such a service that you're doing. But I am so, I mean, I believe me, I'm spoiled enough to be able to say this, so happy with how my life has evolved and developed and turned out that, like, I would just be like, keep it up. You know, you're going to make all the same mistakes. You're going to be in all the same good relationships you were in. You're going to be in all the same bad relationships that you were in. You're going to go and have all the same good professors that you had, have all the same bad professors that you had, get all the good grades you're going to get all the B's that you're going to get. I learned so much from all of that, that I would not want to, I would not give myself the sports almanac, you know, I would not do that. I think that would ruin my life, and it certainly would ruin Hill Valley. But like, you know, I would not want to send the world to an alternate 1985, you know, the alternate timeline. But no, seriously, like I could I be richer now? Yeah. Could I be more successful or more famous or more whatever? Yeah, absolutely. But I'm happy. And that happiness and my career were all informed and were all as a direct or indirect result of all of those experiences through childhood, school, and college, and grade school and college. And so I would say keep it up and enjoy the ride is what I would say. Maybe that's stupid, or maybe it sounds cheesy or something, but I've never been asked that question. It's a very popular question though. Like what is 2020 you tell 1996 you or whatever, you know, but I never really thought about it before. And so keep it up and enjoy the ride. And I wouldn't even have to tell myself to enjoy the ride, because for the most part, I have, and I do every day. And even then, as studious as I was, I carried a briefcase, not a backpack on most, you know, for most of my school career, including college. But I still had fun. Like I still was, and even though I didn't start drinking until I was 21, like I still had fun. Like I was just like, you know, as much of a straight arrow as I may have been, I still was rebellious and I still was, you know, had a sense of humor and I still was very, I think, very realistic / cynical as I am now. And so I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed it with a reality and that I think I've maintained that sort of made our path to nonfiction filmmaking inevitable. And I never would have thought that either, that I would have been a documentarian, and I wouldn't want to spoil the surprise either for myself, because it's been such a discovery. And I think that's the interesting thing about life, is that you don't know what's going to happen, and you don't know where you're going to learn the most important lessons. I remember in high school, I had an acting teacher who I hated his class. I don't know that I hated him, but I hated his class. I'll tell you right now. The guy's name is David. The guy's name is David Quiet. I'm going to call him out. I hated his class. He knows this. That's why I'm going to say it. I hated his Quiet was spelled K-W-I-A-T. He was a very gifted, still is a very gifted actor. I just saw him in a play last year in Miami where he played Simon Wiesenthal, and he was off the charts brilliant. So David Quiet's class, he was our junior year acting teacher. Oh, I hated that class. I mean, he was like pompous and pretentious, and the exercises were like just so douchey and lame. And by the time I graduated New World School of the Arts, so this is now a year later, I said to him, I don't know what I knew about a fine wine, but my grandparents were very into wines, still are, God bless them. I said to him, I said, David Quiet, we had to do this thing called, I forget what they call it, like senior goodbyes. That's appropriate. How can I forget? Senior goodbyes. So we're, the whole senior theater class gets to stand up in front of all the theater students, ninth grade through 12th, and say your goodbyes, you know, kind of say what you learned and who you liked and what the experience was. And what I told the underclassmen were, I said, pay attention in David Quiet's class junior year. You're going to hate it, but it is like a fine wine. It gets better with age. And it dawned on me, and this was obviously a slight, I didn't, to our senior acting professor, but I said it was the best acting class I took at this school. And I did not know it, and I did not appreciate it contemporaneously, you know, in real time. I said, but pay attention. I said, you can hate it, and you can hate him, but pay attention, because it is the best acting class you'll take at this school. And I remember, I said, like, so I go to flash forward 15 years later or so, roughly. I go to a dinner, a gala for the 25th anniversary of New World School of the Arts. Because the school was about 10 years old when I, at the time I'd attended it, and 10 or 15 years old. So this is like 10, 15 years later. So, and I find myself at a table sitting next to David Quiet, who was really great to see him. And he tells the table the story about my senior goodbye and how I had said that his class was, his class was like a fine wine that got better with age. And here I was all these years later. Here he was. I mean, I don't know how many hundreds of classes, you know what I mean, of students later, citing this this quote, my own quote, back to me, which I was terribly, terribly flattered by. And obviously he was flattered by the compliment. And I certainly meant it that way. And so, I mean, that's the only thing is to just, you know, some of these experiences you will not appreciate
in real time.
Yeah. And I will not fault anyone for that. But if you realize that adapt the cheesy metaphor, like, you know, the classroom, life is the classroom, you know, mm-hmm. or the world is the classroom and life is the class. And to that end, I've never left school. Every one of our documentaries is a course, you know, that we have to educate ourselves in and ask questions. It's everyone's a science experiment. It's literally the scientific method that we go through when we do a documentary. You know, you have a title, you ask a question, you go through an experiment and the steps, and you draw a conclusion. Maybe you don't in the documentary, but the conclusion is the documentary, is the science fair experiment, you know, itself. And so I've always, you know, and you have to be intellectually curious, and you have to enjoy the journey, and you have to, know that's what these are. That these are just lessons for better or for worse, and hopefully, if not in the moment, that with some distance and perspective, that you will appreciate them for what they brought to your life. And I'm certainly getting to that age where I do.
And that is our show. If you'd like to know more about Billy Corbin, follow him on Twitter at Billy Corbin. If you enjoyed this episode, could you take a moment to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts? It helps grow the show and helps us continue to get great guests. If you have a question you'd like our experts to answer, email us at howigotintocollegepodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at howigotin, and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/howigotin. I'm David Whalen. Thanks for listening. And I'll talk to you next time on How I Got Into College.